Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm very pleased to have with me today on Campus FM, University Matters, Dr. Brenda Murphy. I'm very happy that she's with us today because we go back quite a long way. In fact, we shared some lectures when we were at university. So,
we certainly did.
Yeah. She is now a senior lecturer in the Department of Gender Studies. That's within the Faculty of Social Wellbeing. And I'll just say a few words about Dr. Murphy. With the first and second degree in Psychology and Communications Cultural Studies, Dr. Murphy joined the University of Malta in 1994, having worked in the advertising industry in Dublin and London. She then read for a PhD at Goldsmiths College, University of London, in the area of media consumption and diaspora. In 2009, Dr. Murphy moved from the Department of Communication Studies to the Institute for Design and Development of Thinking. Then in November 2013, a new Department of Gender Studies in the Faculty of Social Wellbeing was set up, and she joined this department as a founder member. Setting up this department has been a team-driven exercise, breaking ground in formulating a department that will offer various postgraduate programs. Alongside an extensive teaching experience and research projects, she has supported her department administratively and has nurtured links between the university and industry by coordinating projects in advertising and media research, which has enabled students to work with bodies such as the police, civil protection, Department of Health, National Commission for Promotion of Equality, and the Employment and Training Corporation, developing advertising and promotional material for them, using print and broadcast media. Furthermore, she's worked closely with the Malta Broadcasting Authority as chair of its Gender Advisory Committee and has acted as advisor to the National Commission for Promotion of Equality when queries occur around negative gender or racial material in national advertising campaigns. Dr. Murphy is author of many papers and several chapters in respect to journals and publications, but today we are going to talk mainly about her recently published book, Brewing Identities, Globalization, Guinness, and the Production of Irishness. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Murphy.
Thank you very much, Patricia. That was lovely to hear all the things I've been doing. I'm tired now. I need to lie down.
Well, you'll have to keep going for another 28 minutes, I'm afraid. I think that perhaps as a kick-off question, shall we say,
shoot,
the first chapter of your book is entitled Why Guinness? Within that chapter, obviously, you give the structure of the book. But perhaps you could explain to us what attracted you to Guinness as a subject for originally a PhD and eventually this book that came out of it a bit later on.
Okay, so what brought me to the topic? What brings any researcher to their topic? I argue, and I say this to students and colleagues, all research is biographical. We are embedded in our research. Whatever it is that we get involved in, it is because of who we are that we get involved in it. And so that said, why would an Irish woman living in Malta write about Guinness and diaspora? I think already starts to answer the question. An Irish woman, immediately we think of Guinness when we think of Ireland, and we talk, that's part of the book's discussion. But the diaspora and the experience of diaspora is one that we don't often read about unless it's written by people who have that lived experience. And what brought me to the idea or the questioning around Guinness as a cultural icon and as a marketed icon and as a brand and brought me to asking questions about it was quite a lived experience moment, and it happened in Malta 20 odd years ago. I wasn't long living in Malta, and I was walking down Slim Seafront, and there's an old shop front which was derelict and closed down. But as I looked in the window, there was the remains, the remnants of its display. And one of the things that was on its display was a can of Guinness. And as I looked in the window and saw this can of Guinness, I was transported back physically, emotionally, all my senses, back to another place. It was a bridge between where I was standing on the Slieve seafront and home. And home in all of its evocative terms. And so that moment struck me as a real lived experience where I saw the Guinness, Guinness in a can, no self-respecting Irish person would drink Guinness in a can because we prefer it to be draft. But nonetheless, Guinness in a can was the substitute and was the standing signifier, if you like, for Guinness and Irishness and home and homesickness and displacement and being somewhere else and being other somewhere else and all of that. Even though that was a long, long time ago, and I was an undergraduate at the time, so it was more than 20 years. My maths is terrible. It planted a seed. And as I was going through my own professional development and my own academic development, that seed grew. And as I sat down to think about my PhD, and I was thinking about it seriously in terms of the theoretical positioning, etc., I recognize that Guinness as this profound brand and profound icon and profound sign had a lot to say for itself and required more research. And I wanted to look at how it was behaving as a brand, but also how it was behaving as a cultural artifact. And so that led me then to thinking about it in terms of what the Guinness family, the Guinness company, the Guinness brand itself, the Guinness product, what they all encompassed and what they carried with them for Irish people living in Ireland, but then also, as the very interesting next question, what it meant for people living abroad, Irish people living abroad. And of course, when we think about Irish people living abroad, we think immediately of London and New York, and then we think of Australia and further places, but they're the biggest spaces. And so for my original research, I had gone to Dublin, London and New York and carried out focus group interviews with mostly men, mostly in London and New York, mostly men, because they would have been the most public occupied, if you like, players in the diaspora. And it was easy to find them in the pubs and get them to talk about what it meant. But in Ireland itself, I got to speak to men and women in pubs, and it was a different experience because it was women occupying as much of the space as men. So yeah, I don't know if that starts to answer your question.
Absolutely, yes, very clearly. Your book is wide-ranging, as you've just suggested, and as the title suggests, in fact. But perhaps we can start off talking about Guinness in Ireland and then pass on to the diaspora in its various manifestations, as you have already indicated. Guinness in Ireland has been going for many years.
1759.
Oh, my goodness, that's going back a lot. Perhaps you could talk to us about the significance of Guinness in Ireland itself in the past and now.
Okay, a significance in terms of economics, in terms of cultural value, all of those things.
Yes, because they're all so interlinked somehow.
They are. In fact, probably before moving forward, it's useful to think about how I approach the research. And I approach the research thinking about in terms of cultural consumption. And there was a wonderful model developed in the mid-80s by Richard Johnson, who is probably the equivalent to Elvis Presley for those who would consider Elvis Presley the top 10. Well, Richard Johnson would be up there for me as a number one. And he had developed this wonderful model called a circuit of culture, and he argued that if you wanted to understand culture properly and how everything was operating within culture, you thought about it in terms of four places or four sites. You thought about it in terms of production and the processes of production and all of that means. And then you stopped and you thought about it in terms of readings. And then you stopped and thought about it in terms of texts. So, for example, Guinness as a text is its advertising and its actual sign in itself. The readings are what people do, the sense people make of them. And then the fourth site was everyday life, the people's lived experiences around that particular artifact, whatever it happened to be, whether it's an iPad or an airline or Guinness as an icon. So what I did logically you stop and you think, well, what about production? In terms of production, what is Guinness? And by simply asking that question, you end up asking lots and lots of other questions. So who were the family behind Guinness? How did Guinness represent itself over the years in Ireland? What was its role socially in Dublin? And then you start to really find interesting answers. Because for me, and this was part of my own lived experience, again, I'm using that term a lot, but it really makes sense. When I grew up in Dublin, we lived near the Ivy Gardens. And at that time, as a kid, that didn't mean much to me, except that it was a place where we could go and play tennis, and there was a swimming pool, and there was lots of other amenities there. But as I started to research this book, I realized that Lord Ivy, who was Guinness family, back in the 1800s, the Guinness family had been one of the great philanthropic energies, if you like. And they're very similar to the Quaker families in the UK, like Cadbury's and Rowntree. And they would have, where they were building up their own economic establishment, had this wonderful predating work-life balance and family-friendly measures, had a wonderful attitude and commitment and ethic and philosophy around how they practiced their production as a factory. And so for people in Dublin living in the 18 and 1900s, Guinness was the employer. If you got a job in Guinness, a little bit like saying getting a job with the civil service, if you got a job with Guinness, that was much, much better because you were employed for life, your family were guaranteed work, you had wonderful extra conditions, you had access to these sports clubs that had been built up, you had access to medical cover and a medical doctor.
Wow.
Guinness long before people could even afford to go to doctors, Guinness provided a clinic for its employees and for their families. And they had a resident surgeon, doctor, who was referred to as a surgeon, who was quite, there was one, Landon, I think was his name. He was very forward-looking, and he actually even developed cultural programs for the wives. Now, obviously, back at that period, it was a male-dominated employment area. But he went on to consider that if these men were not healthy in themselves, in their diets, etc., then it was going to affect their working lives. And so they would bring in the wives and run cookery classes for them. And then they ran cultural programs for them. So there was a lot of stuff going on just for the people who got employed by Guinness. And then if you move outside of that, Guinness as a family were very busy doing things like reclaiming marshland and building St. Stephen's Green, which is an iconic point in Dublin. And that's just tip of the iceberg. If you look into chapter two or three, you'll see how much Guinness actually did to contribute to the landscape of Dublin, physically, geographically, for amenities, and then socially and culturally for families and for well-being.
One can imagine then, with that kind of background, we were heading for iconic status.
Already.
Already.
Already. Because if you talk about Guinness to people in Dublin, everybody has a family member who worked there and were well dealt with and well employed. And so there is a good, strong love, if you like, within Dublin especially, for the Guinness project, which is interesting because when you think about Ireland, you immediately think about a Catholic Ireland, and Guinness was a Protestant family. But none of that comes into play when people talk to you about Guinness and about the Guinness family, about the Guinness dynasty, and what it stood for and what it left behind.
What about the kind of drinking culture in Ireland, the pub culture?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Guinness was sold through pubs,
yes.
Possibly owned by Guinness, I don't know.
No, they're all independent.
They're all independent.
But yes, Guinness was distributed through pubs, and you wouldn't have had Guinness any other way. And I remember a wonderful story my aunt tells about my grandfather, who loved his pint of Guinness, his regular one pint an evening, every evening. But they had gone from Dublin down to the west of Ireland, where they originally came from. They were farming people, and he'd gone into a pub for a drink, and he could see through the gap into the room behind the bar, and he could see this woman with two jugs of Guinness, and she was mixing them. This is back in the 50s or 60s, before refrigeration and all of the sort of high-tech stuff that we have going on at the moment for Guinness. She was trying to get the temperature right, so there's cold and the warm. And he looked in and he saw her. And apparently he said to my grandmother, look at her messing around with the Guinness, as in she was just ruining the whole thing for him. And he turned on his heel and he walked out. So they're little cameos of how people felt a little bit of an ownership around the product, which is something you don't get every day with other products in our everyday life. So Guinness has had this really interesting relationship with the consumer and with the non-consumer. And in fact, in chapter three, I talk about myths and rituals and histories. And I argue that much of the ritual and myth is driven by the consumer and the non-consumer, which is really interesting. that a non-consumer has some sort of impact on a brand or on a product. And that comes about from talking to people about the kinds of rituals and myths and stories that they have in relation to Guinness itself. And again, these stories were all gathered through sitting in pubs and talking to people.
What about the social entry for Guinness? Was it a drink for every social class? Was it a working man's drink? Or did it depend simply on where the pubs were?
Well, the pubs were everywhere. even in Ulysses, they make reference to the fact that the pubs were everywhere. You couldn't cross Dublin without passing the front door of a pub, no matter what route you took. James Joyce talks about that in the first chapter of Ulysses. Who has access to Guinness? Who are the drinkers? I would say everybody. From the working person, the working man, right up to the academic. For example, in Dublin, there was a strong literary pub tradition, and all the greats like Miles na Gcoplan, Brian Nolan, Brendan Behan, Tobin, thinking of all the different authors that have come out of Ireland, most of them, they all would have gone to particular pubs like O'Dade's or wherever in Dublin and would have sat and drank in those pubs. And
Drank Guinness,
of course. But people would have known, oh, if you want to go down and talk to Brian O'Nolan, he's going to be down in such and such a pub, and you can go and have a conversation with this guy. And then he'll go home and write something brilliant that's going to be published a year from now, and we'll all be talking about it. So Guinness was drank and enjoyed by many, across all stratas, I would argue.
One of the little cameo stories that I loved in the book was the guy who was quite a sophisticated person. I can't remember exactly what he was, but he used to wear wellies to go into the pub in wherever it was, Connemara or somewhere, and because it was a farmer's pub, and he actually muddied his boots to make it look as though he was part of the group.
Yes,
you wouldn't walk into that kind of a pub dressed like a toff.
No. You have read the book, thank you. That's one of my favourite stories. That was told to me by the man's daughter in Dublin. And she was describing, he was a businessman, and he spent a lot of time driving on the road, and he was mostly going around West Coast. But he loved his pint of Guinness, and he knew that some pubs were better than others for Guinness. And all respondents were able to tell me this. Some pubs are better than others. Mm. If you go into a pub, you check the pub, you look at other people's pints, you see how it's standing in the glass. You go and you ask people, is the pint good here? There's all sorts of military intelligence carried out before you even commit to a pub and to its pint. But this man had identified that the better pubs for serving Guinness were the farmer's pubs. The hotels would have served Guinness too, but in the day, the farmers' pubs probably would have had a greater run on the barrel and things like that, so it would have been a better pint. Mm-hmm. But he realised he couldn't walk into the pub wearing his suit, or he would have been out of place. So he bought a pair of wellies and he muddied them up, because he couldn't go in with clean wellies. That wouldn't have been authentic. So the whole issues of authenticity get explored in the story. In fact, what's wonderful about this is it raises as many questions as it answers, and you get to talk about issues that you never thought you were going to talk about. So issues around racism, issues around hybridity and authenticity, issues around contested identities, all emerged out of the research. And I ended up writing and reading stuff that I never imagined I was going to face and engage with.
As time is passing, and I knew this was going to be a difficult to keep to the 28 minutes, I cannot not talk with you about the agenda issue. So women and Guinness, women going to pubs, which was not until very recently even accepted, certainly not on their own.
Yes.
And also, following on from that, how were you accepted as a researcher, a woman, talking to focus groups about Guinness?
Okay, two great questions. Do we have another 28 minutes?
About eight.
Okay. So, first of all, the women and the pub and Guinness. I loved the fact that the respondents in Ireland, the young women in Ireland, were occupying the pub space without major negotiation, as in they felt that it was a place that they had a right to be. Women often have contested relationships with public spaces for safety issues, etc., and for judgment issues. But a lot of the young women were unapologetic in their entrance. However, they would say that as their first position. Then they would switch into telling me what their strategies were for negotiating those spaces. So they would never go in on their own, very rarely. They would always go in with somebody else. And they did always often talk about the fact that there was a danger of being judged if you're just sitting in the pub on your own. And that was a little bit worrying for me, because when I realised in Ireland women were having this sort of negotiated a relationship with the pub. It made me, because I was arguing that the pub was operating as an alternative, a bridge between home and where the diaspora person was. My worry was that if women in the US, the UK were being excluded in some way from this community space, that they were going to be marginalized even further. But in fact, the women in the UK and the US were a different story, because the pubs really did operate around a lot of community. They often were heavily involved with church community. And in fact, when I interviewed Father Colm Campbell, who was the head of, or the chair of the Immigrants Association out in New York, he talked about how important that the pub was for men and women who were out in Queens, where they would all congregate and support each other emotionally, financially, socially. And so, for example, if there was a tragedy, let's say one of the, and they were mostly illegal workers at the time, let's say one of them had an accident and died, there would be a gathering in his pub or her pub that night, and there would be money raised, family flown back from Ireland to accompany the person back home. And he cited lots of situations when that happened. He says, for him, the pub was as important as people coming in Sunday to listen to the gospel. And women had access to that as well. One of my favourite stories was told to me again in Dublin by a woman called Gronia. And she talked about how she liked to go into the pub on her own, but always felt that it was something that she needed to somehow dance around a little bit. And she found the solution. She chose as her favourite pub Mulligan's, which is a famous pub in Dublin and famous for its pint of Guinness. So that was the first box ticked. And she would go in there with her Times crossword, and she would sit with her Times crossword and drink her pint of Guinness. And she said, and that in itself gave, the fact that she was in a pub that was famous for Guinness and she was doing her crossword, she felt gave her the statement that I'm here just for my pint. I'm not here waiting for a boyfriend. I haven't been stood up. I'm not trying to pick somebody up. And there were all the things she had to make sure that she'd put to rest before she could go in and sit down comfortably. So they were the things she was doing. So women in the pub and Guinness, lots of women do enjoy Guinness, myself included. And yes, women do have found ways to access. However, women in history around the pub have been very interesting in the way that they've been described. And we know that there were three major spaces within which women could go into a pub in the past, up to say the 1950s and 60s. One was the old woman who went in for her medicinal drink and she sat in the snug. And she may have been in on her own and she may have been in with somebody else, but she was elderly, so she wasn't sexually available or out to always constructed around sex and availability. The second was the female bar worker who could be employed behind the bar, adding some sort of, I'm not sure what, to the bar itself, sometimes order and sometimes decoration. And the third was the women who went into the pub to work. So they were going in as sex workers. And that was, there were the three places that women occupied a space in the pub up until quite recently.
What about identity? If I start using the word identity in the last 2 minutes, I'm sure you'll just sort of be very annoyed with me because it's such a big subject. But the identity, say, let's take New York because we don't have enough time to discuss the others. But that idea of Guinness, pubs, Irish identity is a bit of a cliche, and it's obviously much more complicated than one would immediately imagine. Could you just very briefly explain, as you do in your book, why one cannot just call this Irish identity as, imagine it as one block?
Okay, I'll answer that, and I'll also answer your previous question, which I didn't fully answer yet. I talked about women in pubs. I didn't talk about myself as a woman, as a researcher. So I'll tie those two together, and I'll tell you how it felt for me going into Queens in New York and Manhattan in New York. And I'd selected particular bars in each place because I wanted to capture the well-educated, the professional Irish people. And then I wanted to also capture the stories of the people who are living on the margins, the people who are illegals, the people who didn't have green cards. And Queens was the place to go for that. So I was talking to the insurance people and the bankers in Manhattan. I was talking to the people who were out on the construction sites when I went to Queens. When I went out to Queens, I was scared. I was on my own. I was in my 30s. I wasn't exactly a scaredy cat kid. But I went into Queen's knowing that I had to go into mostly wall-to-wall occupied pubs that had construction workers in them. So I was going to a deeply male place. And I was going to go in and ask these guys to sit down and talk to me about how it felt to be a migrant living in New York and how it felt to be sitting drinking Guinness in a pub, and get them to talk about that. And I remember thinking that this kind of research must require the biggest, deepest pocket of courage, because I was a female asking the questions and because I was positioning myself as an Irish woman. That bridged it a little. And that helped, because as I went in and said, sorry, guys, you know, I know you've just stopped working. I know it's a Friday afternoon. I know all you want to do is have a bit of fun. I'll buy you a pint. Would you mind having a chat with me? And making sure they didn't think I was trying to pick them up, you know, all six of them at the same time, because I needed six for a minimum of six for my conversation. So all sorts of nonverbals had to be implemented. So it really trains you well as a researcher, this kind of ethnographic research. But every time I sat with people like this and I got them to talk, I realized that you must discard your preconceived notions at the door, because you're not going in and talking to Paddy who's drinking a pint in the corner. Each of these guys who sat around the table with me had different stories to tell and had different experiences, and none of them were the essentialist version of Irishness that we think about when we think about the worst kind of stereotype.
Well, I'm very sorry that our time has come to an end. Perhaps we could do another programme on this, because there's so much more to discuss. I'd just like to thank Dr. Brenda Murphy for coming on University Matters to talk to us about her latest book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patricia.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.